How About Them Podcast with Landon McCool.
How about them Cowboys indeed?
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the How About Them Podcast. I am your host, Landon McCool. Well, we got a doozy this week. We got my good buddy Keith Mullins in, and we get a nice little chat going. This one is a little bit long, just for everyone involved. It tops out over an hour, so sit in, relax, and enjoy some good Cowboys draft talk with me and Keith Mullins. And with no further ado, here we go.
Wide 80! Wide 80! Kill, kill, kill!
All right, guys. He's a contributor for USA Today's Cowboys Wire. He's a co-host of the Crunch Time podcast with our mutual good friend, KD Drummond, and a member of the secret cabal of Cowboys bloggers that we never discuss in public, Keith Mullins. Welcome, sir. How are you doing?
Outstanding in every way, sir. How are you?
I'm great, man. I'm glad to have you on the show. We are less than 10 days away from the big show. How's your sleep level? Are you still tinkering with the board, or do you kind of have all the pieces in place where you think they should go?
I think the board is good.
Okay.
I think we're done. We're done fussing with it. You know, we've reached the point where we as folks outside of NFL buildings, we've pretty much stopped receiving actionable intelligence at this point.
Yeah, right?
There aren't a lot of new data points coming in for us that would drive players too far up or down. So, you know, you might have those guys that carry an identical or near identical grade, and maybe depending on how you wake up that morning, you could flip flop two of them. But yeah, I think the time for significant moves has passed at this point. Hopefully, like it has for the teams as well.
Yeah, and hopefully they're, like, you know, getting it all in pen at this point as opposed to pencil, which is kind of where we are at this point with only 10 days left to go. So, and I think before we get too deep into this, I would like to start at the kind of 10,000-foot view and then zoom in a little bit. So, you know, after spending – and you're one of these guys too, Keith, who – and this is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on is that you kind of seemingly are doing draft – all year round, or you seem to be watching guys at least all year round, where I don't have that same process, which is why I like having this discussion with people that do, because I do think that we can provide different, like, points of view for these prospects. And I think that there is a coach's look, kind of, you know, just the short, quick, you know, rendition, and then the scouts who have been on this, and that's kind of your view, where you've been watching some of these guys, you know, since before the NFL season was over. So from the 10,000 foot view, after spending the last few months looking at these guys and looking at the draft strengths and weaknesses, how do you feel the Cowboys did in setting themselves up to be able to take advantage of it?
Yeah, I think their entire approach to the offseason really, really showed their hand and intent, but it paired and married with what the class looked like. So I think all of their offseason activities really were directed with this class in mind and what they thought they could get done on draft weekend. So to that point, the way they conducted themselves in free agency, you know, we've talked at length in the past about how much this staff and this front office loves the idea of getting the band back together. And so in a free agency and hard cap era, their first choice is almost always to bring back the guys that they know their strengths and their limitations, the guys that know the system and their way of conducting themselves, you know, how they go about their business. They're far more comfortable with retaining their own and adding youth to that than they are with bringing in outside big ticket free agents, for example, and over the recent history anyway. So, but then the way that they clearly showed their intent to me was we saw that happen completely on the offensive side of the ball.
Yeah.
So as they just kept checking boxes on offense, including doing things like bringing back the pair of wide receivers when I anticipated they'd probably only bring back one. And so, you know, making sure that McFadden was back. They really set themselves up so that they literally don't have to draft an offensive player in this class. There's no reason anything that could crop up even in camp, you know, the right tackle. I know that people have a circle around right tackle. Some people would like to see Collins at least tried again back out there. Question about whether Chaz Green can stay healthy enough. He was drafted for this job, mm-hmm. but can he stay healthy enough to really be Doug Free's successor, as much trouble as he's had going all the way back to his time at Florida with that. So, but if right tackle crops up, it seems like every single year there's a recent starter at right tackle that's available all summer long. And, you know, and that guy usually signs at a discount and ends up starting for the team that signs him, but someone signs him in August. Yeah. And so, so even if it isn't something that's completely covered by the moves they made in free agency, it's small gaps that are left really that are typically can be filled in that second wave of free agency, whether it's a veteran being released or something of that nature. So I think they really covered themselves on the offensive side to at least maintain the status quo. And it's important with the young quarterback that he's got pieces he's familiar with. And so they can go forward, continue to build on the piece, the, you know, the installations that they did last year and add more dimension to that offense. Hopefully he gets more comfortable with, I don't know, superstar pieces like Dez. And and he can sort out, you know, obviously we've talked as well about, you know, some of the discomfort with a receiver that doesn't create a lot of separation but can dominate at the catch point, and how do you deliver that guy the ball versus somebody like Cole who's going to create a bunch of space for you. So, but I think they gave him pieces he's familiar with. So everyone's going to expect the offense to score. I think what was surprising, at least superficially, with how they conducted themselves in the offseason was the decree that they intended to upgrade certain spots, especially in the secondary. So I think they even covered themselves to the point that they would go play on a, you know, play on a Sunday afternoon with the defensive line that they have. They're comfortable with all the guys in the room. The room's actually pretty crowded right now.
Yeah, so, there's a lot of people in the room.
It's a lot of people in the room. There aren't a lot of maybe shining lights in the room. It's not blinding star power necessarily in the room. But they could play, and they trust them all to execute their responsibilities, and they could play a game. Where they left themselves in a spot where you question whether or not they could get through more than a couple weeks of the season was by, you know, letting both safeties go and letting both corners go in, you know, Claiborne, Carr, and then Church and Wilcox. I think most people expected one of those two to come back as, you know, one of each of those pairs to come back as well and let them cover themselves and go into it with the mythical BPA approach. and as we know, need always factors in. When teams are building that board, need is part of it, but so is the depth of the class at those positions. And I think when the Cowboys looked at this class, they said the deepest spots in this class are in the secondary. This is an unusually deep safety class. It's a remarkable, spectacularly deep corner group. It may lack the sort of luminaries in the top 10 at corner or top 15 that we've seen in some recent drafts. But boy, when you start to get to where the Cowboys pick, and from there all the way through day two, I mean, they're going to be starters at corner and safety that come out of this draft in round four. So mm-hmm. I think when they looked at that and that depth, and knowing that as long as you pick the right guys, there are going to be the right guys available, that's what gave them the confidence to go ahead and jettison the players they did. And then all of their comments back that up. I mean, I don't know if you were surprised I was to see Stephen Jones speak so candidly about some of the decisions they made in the secondary, but to say, how long do we keep paying guys that aren't making plays? I mean, there's no clearer sign of intent than that they're going to put a big premium on passes defensed plus interceptions. So ball skills in the secondary, and try to get this offense some more short fields and some more opportunities for Dak and Zeke and this line to go to work.
Yeah, my line of demarcation for starter level on my horizontal board was the early fourth for boundary corner. I mean, and that's because of the talent at, you know, the Cowboys currently have, which, you know, isn't a lot. And then you know, the depth, like you talked about, of this class. It's and I think, you know, the funny thing is when, you know, they started releasing defensive backs, I think you could kind of tell who had looked at the draft and who hadn't just based on their reaction. You know, I think the people that hadn't had a chance to kind of dive deep into what the names and what the bodies looked like were absolutely terrified that the Cowboys just gave away almost their entire secondary without anything in return. And then the people that obviously had studied this draft are licking their chops because they know that they can be replaced with a whole bunch of young talent that, you know, that may very well end up being twice the player that these guys that walked out by the end of the season, by their rookie season. So, yeah, I think that they did a good job. I do agree that just in sheer volume, it is a little intimidating how much they have to do still in the defensive backfield. But I do agree that I think that they clearly saw what was ahead of them and were ready to allow the draft to kind of rebuild their secondary. And you know, like I feel like it was just kind of one of those things where, like, they're ready to rip the Band-Aid off and just kind of start over with this whole thing.
That's it. It's a rip and replace type of season for the Cowboys in the secondary. And with that intent, you mentioned sort of the level of, you know, consternation that caused across the fan base with – And national media too freaked out.
Yeah.
Cowboys got rid of their entire secondary. Well, they intend to get better there. You know, it's not that they're now just gonna.
You know, we decided not to have a secondary. We're just not gonna do it. You know, I just think that people, you know, like, look, Pittsburgh had pretty good success having two kind of younger players play in their defensive backfield last year. Cowboys have shown, and we talk about this a lot, the Cowboys have shown their propensity and their ability to be able to plug and play rookies in because of the design of their scheme and how they've made their scheme. They designed their scheme in such a way that young players or inexperienced players in their scheme can come in and pick it up quickly and perform. And I just think that, you know, they're finally kind of fully leaning in on their philosophy and their trusting their process, I guess, and I think that's what this all season was them fully committing to that and saying, okay, our scouts see a gluttony of defensive backs coming out of this draft, so it's probably time to go ahead and start this turnover process, and then that's what they did, and it's going to be interesting to see how it works out, obviously.
Yeah, I think get younger, get faster is never a bad mantra in
especially
the modern
on defense,
NFL, right?
You know, especially on defense, you know, it's not... You're reacting. It's all reaction on defense. So I think, you know, you get younger, faster kids, and they're gonna, you know, they don't have to think about a ton. Just go get the ball, you know.
Yeah, well, and I think another significant point is they mentioned quite a bit how infectious that enthusiasm of youth was on offense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything from, you know, before they go out and take a knee before the victory to, you know, Zach horsing around in the huddle. And that offensive line, the amount of fun they have together, and then of course, you know, Dak and Zeke's personalities, and the amount of fun that they bring to apparently everything they do.
Yeah.
And so on and off the field,
apparently,
fun first. That's the policy, at least of the running back. So, but at any rate, but they talked about how much it meant and how much, you know, just energy it brought to the building. Well, they don't have that same thing on defense. They don't have that same level of enthusiasm. So they don't have that same level of domination, obviously. And so, but being able to put a bunch of guys, and really defense is the side of the ball that can function even better on enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, offense is all Swiss watch precision and timing and execution. And while defensive responsibilities are critical, defenses can run on emotion.
Yeah.
Because you have to react, and you have, and because you're left out on the field and have to, you know, be able to continue until you get them off the field, or, you know, or stop us or create a turnover. But the level of energy has to stay so high on defense to prevent long drives and all and that type of thing that it really caters to your point. Adding that youth on that side of the ball, it's even better suited to it. So I think if they draft with specific jobs in mind, get those guys ready for that limited job, you know, take as much responsibility off of the young players as you can and give them, you know, one job to focus on. weak defensive end is a great example.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
a pretty, pretty simple position. In
I'm
this
glad
defense.
You brought that up. Yes.
it's one job.
Yes.
Right. So, yeah. so that's why when people talk about, well,
DJ
why would
Watt?
The Cowboys, when people talk about why would the Cowboys look at all these linebacker conversions?
Mm-hmm.
Well, edge is edge to a large degree from a responsibility perspective. And then they take and strip 3/4 of the responsibilities off a kid that played linebacker in college
mm-hmm.
and tell him, guess what? We're going to let you come out, get off low and hot, and your job is get upfield.
Yeah.
And how many times have we heard Rod say, read run on the way to the quarterback, but just go.
Mm-hmm.
And so for that position, it's easier than the job they've been doing for 4 years or 1.5 in TJ Watt's case. But it lends itself to early success if you're the right type of athlete, and I'm sure we'll talk about that here as we go.
Yeah, actually, it's a good segue into our next section, but I mean, just to bring that up, I do think that that's a huge thing because that's why we talk a lot about the physicality of these weak side defensive ends, because really that's what's important. I mean, the fact that they, you know, and it's funny because you hear the argument all the time, and it's not just TJ Watt, it's just that I hear that argument specifically about him a lot, but I hear it about Bowser as well. And some of these other guys is that, well, they played this outside linebacker. Oh, they stood up. And I'm like, yeah, so their job's going to be easier. Like, I mean, those are things that are harder to do as an athlete. If you're asking an explosive athlete to be explosive while lining up in a 3-point stance, TJ Watt and Bowser, like these guys have been playing football since, you know, however long they've been playing football. They can get into a 3-point stance and fire out of it. You know, it's not like that is such an unlearned skill that they can't do it. It's really the opposite way that's kind of more the problem. And so it's so funny to me when really the job is to be explosive. To me, it's to be explosive, to be able to maintain contact through balance through contact, to be able to bend around the edge, to have a counter move. Like those are the kind of the pillars of the position. And so if you haven't been doing that full time, I don't know that it's really difficult to teach you how to do it. It's just, but you have to be able to physically able to do it in order to even be eligible to play the position. So, and I think that kind of leads me to my next question, you know, keeping all that in mind that it is kind of a difficult skill set. It is a physical tool set that is not easy to find necessarily. You and I have discussed the fact that the Cowboys specifically need that weak side defensive end. They call it right defensive end. We'll call it weak side defensive end. It, you know, I mean, it's all the same thing. The guy that's basically screaming off the edge behind the quarterback to kill him, right? So
the Cowboys... Yeah, and to avoid any confusion for folks that maybe aren't familiar with why we call it both, most teams play
yeah.
the majority of the game right-handed, mm-hmm. with the tight end to the quarterback's right or the defense's left, and the open side to the defense's right side. So that's why the right defensive end, if you don't flip them with the tight end, very few teams do anymore. Some will still try it, but you'll get caught. They'll snap the ball while you're changing. So, but if you don't flip them, the guy you line up right will be lined up on the weak side, you know, the vast majority of the time.
The open side. They're also called open side defensive ends.
Right.
I mean, there's 25 different ways to call the position.
Yeah, ask a coach. He'll come up with a different
yes.
name for it.
But the reason we delineate between the two is because usually the strong side or left defensive end is the more stout guy who can play the run. And those body types are a little bit easier to find because they don't require – I mean, they're not easy to find, but they're easier just because of the very specialty nature of the weak defensive end. So – keeping all that in mind, we discussed earlier that we have a ton of bodies in the Cowboys defensive end room right now. And so that makes fighting for a job kind of difficult. So you and I have discussed that really the best situation would be for the Cowboys to secure a defensive end at 28. And I think that, you know, we don't necessarily want to, you know, just completely say that that's the only way that this is a good draft or anything, but if you're going to get a defensive end, if you're going to try to improve your pass rush, you're trying to improve it as from the top guy on your right side, and anything outside of that is really just adding to numbers. You're not necessarily affecting, you know, the skill level of that position at the starting level at all. So I guess my question for you is if something happens and the Cowboys are unable to secure a defensive end at 28 and their right defensive end board, like, you know, the list of guys that they think could specifically play right defensive end gets wiped before 60, is there any reason for you, in your mind, to try and draft a guy who may not be a good fit at right defensive end or is clearly just a left defensive end?
So I think the visits tell us that they at least have a little bit of concern about the left side as well. And I've said, if anyone engages on Twitter, and most folks seem to these days, but I've certainly mentioned on Twitter that if you look at the Cowboys' defensive end room, which is packed full of bodies right this second, I don't know if there's a starter in the room week one. Not necessarily on a talent basis, but because of just the entire complexion of the situation. DeMarcus Lawrence, they drafted to play right side defensive end. They determined through letting him play that he was not a right side defensive end in the NFL, which should be your guy that's most able to beat one-on-one the other team's best pass blocker. They decided that wasn't DeMarcus Lawrence. But he can play the run very well. So they put DeMarcus Lawrence on the left side and decided that was his home. But he's had his second back surgery, a year apart. So we don't know. We're certainly not getting a lot of candid discussion about his readiness as he gets ready for this season. I think we've heard a little bit from his teammates on social media, that he's getting ready. But I think accompanying the comments that he was getting ready was him running in one of those zero gravity or reduced gravity rigs on a treadmill, mm-hmm. right? That takes the pressure off of all of the impact out of the activity of running, which tells me, thank goodness it's April because there's a long time.
Because he's not quite ready yet.
But
impact is part of the job description, for what I understand.
It's involved, at least on occasion. Occasional impact, must be able to lift boxes over 70 pounds. I think that was all right there on the application.
You got to read the small print, Keith. Got to read the small print.
Exactly. There's an OSHA thing that goes with that for safety. So is DeMarcus Lawrence going to be ready week one to not only play but play in an impactful way, which we haven't seen in a while? From DeMarcus Lawrence, or is he going to be a pup candidate that misses the first 6 weeks of the season? If he does, well, then if he's not quite ready, then that's not a starter. I think as much as people are excited about the promise and the youth of David Irving, the team seems convinced that they would still like him rushing inside on money package downs, right? Nickel and dime package, mm-hmm. Known pass situations, so they could get a speedier guy outside of him. And also that he seems to work best before his tongue starts to drag, meaning that for 20-25 snaps, we'll give him we'll do this diplomatically and say that he runs pretty hot, and so he tends to get tired kind of fast. But for him, he seems to be most effective in short doses of play, reduced snap counts. So maybe he's not going to give you full time starter snaps, and you know. We'll hear over and over again from everyone that the Cowboys play 8 defensive linemen every week. And in this rotation, any of these rookies will get as many snaps as anyone else will. We hear that. And I think that more often than not, that is out of necessity because they don't have guys that are effective for 50 snaps a game. But we've seen this staff, and I think we've seen the staff on both sides of the ball, say that if you're one of our best players, you can tap out if you want to. We're going to leave you out there. So that certainly has applied to the offensive backfield. But you know, even if you go back to when this team had, other defenders, their best defenders tend to eat a ton of snaps, and that rotation goes away. If there's a weak side defensive end that emerges, you know, that they draft, and he's playing well, versus the run and pass, he's not going to play 20 snaps a game.
No.
He's going to eat starter snaps, right? So I think that they haven't really had it. They didn't think Maoa was a starter, so he didn't play starter snaps. He got benched midway through the season. So they just haven't had that guy. So when you don't have that guy, your best chance is to run fresh bodies at people that are starting to wear down a little bit. And it's a sound strategy to get some production and try and win these games. But there's no doubt that you'd rather have your best pass rusher on the field in the fourth quarter, and you're not going to rotate him out simply because he's on a pitch count. So they don't really they have a bunch of twos and threes, and DeMarcus Lawrence a question mark for health. So when you looked at the visit list, we know the Cowboys differentiate between strong side and weak side, left and right defensive end archetypes. To your point, they like really long, heavier, you know, 270 type guys on the strong side. On the weak side, it's what everyone thinks of. If someone tells you it's a tweener, that's should be a 3-4 outside linebacker, that's their guy.
Yeah, it's so funny how that keeps happening over and over again. That everyone's like, oh, no, they don't want that guy. He's a linebacker. And I'm like, oh, for God's sake, guys, how many times we had Leonard Floyd and Anthony Barr and, like, you know, all these guys that were linebackers.
Drafting Gregory at 235 pounds, right? All of it. Right? Between the guys that they've drafted to try and fill that spot, DeMarcus Lawrence was 252 when they drafted him. He might be just a shade north of that today. But so these guys, that's what they look for all over and over. 250, tell me you got 34-inch arms. Tell me you've got a 10 split that's down around 1.6. Over and over and over, guys that match that same template. And the only thing that seems to make them take an edge rusher, pluck him from the group, and throw him over there in that bucket that's marked linebacker, is if his arms are shorter than 33 inches. And if that guy doesn't have that length, boom, linebacker. But at end, we keep seeing them fall in love or draft the guy that is a long, fast, 3-4 outside linebacker because of the responsibilities they put on that position. They're going to line him up in an outside shade and tell him, get upfield at all costs. That's the guy that can do it. Gumby with the rocket strapped to his back, right, is the ideal fit. Problem is, that guy goes in the top 10. So then at 28, you're going to get some less complete version of that, like a guy that didn't do it in college, which is why we fall to guys like T.J. Watt and Bowser, who show the traits but weren't asked to do that specific job on a frequent basis in Bowser's case, or on any basis in Watt's case. I don't think his hand ever touched the ground except to get up after sacking somebody. So a little bit different. But when I was talking about the visits, not to get too far spun off on specific prospects, they brought in a bunch of guys that we know based on how they differentiate that they'll see as strong side defensive ends. That'll include everything from Taco, Deshaun Hall from A&M. I think Derek Barnett falls into that category, although I question whether he's really strong enough to hold up against the run on that side.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a bunch of these guys, there's a whole second group. And people wanted to lump them all in and say, these are the defensive ends they would consider taking at 28. And I think it's really two groups. It's the weak side ends they would consider taking at 28. That's Watt, Bowser, probably Charles Harris, even though he's on the very fringes of their templates. But I could see them being, you know, I could see him as the fourth guy in the group. I couldn't see him leading the group. And then Tackers McKinley, right? That's your group at 28. All the rest of those ends, all the way down through Terrell Basham, who I know you agree is a strong side defensive end.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you don't today. But
No, I do. I'm sticking with it.
but that whole other group, I think, is a group of strong side defensive ends that they say, if we're wiped out, if our list of weak side defensive ends is gone and we missed, we may still need a guy to play the strong side, but we're not looking for him till 60.
Yeah.
And so I think all those guys, people are going to project Taco to Detroit and Barnett as high as 8 and all of these other places. But I think for the Cowboys, when that board gets stacked, if any of those guys are hanging around at 60 and they don't have a defensive end yet, they might take a strong side defensive end because they still have some concern over that side as well. To me, that's all it said, was that they're worried about both sides. But I don't think there's any way that they take those guys come into that conversation at 28. I don't think that's even any yeah. part of the mindset. 28 to me is four guys, and I think it's those four guys before they even consider a DB at 28, and they'd have to all be gone before they go defensive back in that spot, is my impression. And again, it's the visits. If I look at that defensive back list, I don't have to work hard to convince myself that that's a list of players that they say some of these guys are going to be there at 60.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but some of them will be there. And then we've got some contingencies like Adoree and people like that, and maybe they're that high on Kevin King. I'm not. I think Kevin King's rise, if you want to call it that, I hate talking about late risers, but in that way, it's become very popular for people to put Kevin King in the late first area. And I don't know if that's because they're talking to teams or if they're enamored with the workout plus length. But on tape, I don't have Kevin King near around one grade. So for me, Kevin King's one of the guys that if he's at 60, I wouldn't mind adding him to this team. But I don't think he's a first-round cornerback.
Yeah, and I tend to think that, you know, those guys that, you know, some of these guys that you didn't necessarily mention, like Rivers and guys like that, I think those fall into that category of guys who may not be a good fit at right defensive end. You know, it's not that I don't think that they can play defensive, but I think it's like DeMarcus Lawrence, where, he could play right defensive end. I just don't think I don't think it's his best position. I think they put him at left defensive end because they'd rather get another upgrade at right defensive end and not use Lawrence as their right defensive end pick. And I also think that, you know, kind of to your point, that whether they tag those positions that they like, that they need, or whatever, however need gets inserted into value for the draft picks, I think once the weak side defensive ends are off the board, I think to your point, yeah, that it loses any priority that it had over other positions immediately, and I think it suddenly becomes, you know, I think suddenly defensive end becomes less of a priority than obviously defensive back. I mean, I think immediately defensive back, as soon as the last wide defensive end comes off the board, that's of starter quality, or, you know, even competing starter quality, then cornerback and safety automatically jumps to the front of our need list
And I think a useful illustration of that, at least in terms of my mindset, we know this team values a good example for people. We know this team values the three technique defensive tackle, the one gap guy that gets upfield and should be a pass rush threat. We know they value that spot much higher than they value the one technique that has to take on double teams all day. We've seen that. The number one, you could be the best one technique in the draft. and for some teams, they're going to take that guy in the top 15 picks. For the Cowboys, he's going to be on, you know, Tim Jernigan was an example, right? When he was coming out of Florida State, they saw him as a one tech. Well, he's not going to appear before the second round on their board.
Yeah.
Other teams are going to have him much higher, potentially. But there are other guys. The other way that shows up at defensive end, we heard this come up in Lawrence's draft, where they specifically said he was the last weak defensive end available. Mm-hmm. Was he the last one that was drafted that year? No, but he was the last one that they saw as having the ability to improve their team at the position now, right?
Yeah.
To come in and it doesn't mean week one, but in short order, right? To be a difference maker early in his career, hopefully his rookie season. He was the last one on their list, valuable enough to them that they spent a third round pick to go up higher in round two and get him. This draft, to me, mirrors that exactly, where I think all the way down to Derek Rivers is the last weak defensive end pick as far as guys that we know they looked at. And I think they're all gone by 45. So to me, two things then become possible. If you don't get a weak side defensive end at 28, If your group is burned at 28, and you don't bail, trades would bring too much into the conversation at this point. But if you sit and pick, if you stick and pick at 28, and you didn't get a weak side defensive end, I don't think You're exactly right. I don't think end comes up, right? All of a sudden, we're going to play with the group of ends we have, that full room we have. And that's the way that I could see an offensive player get into the top 100, into the first three rounds for the Cowboys.
Yeah.
If they don't get their defensive end, then an offensive player could be in the second round or the third because they'll still get their DBs. If they get their defensive end, I would be extraordinarily confident that rounds two and three are going to be defensive backs. A safety in a corner, more than likely. And then they'll consider offense. Let's see, tell me which offensive guys are left in round four. But, yeah, if they don't get a defensive end, then that's the only way to me that offense sneaks into the top three rounds. So, and maybe that's where the two offensive visits that they had, you know, maybe those guys, rather than targets in the top three rounds, maybe they're contingencies in case, because we know they like to, everyone war games everything, they like to cover all their bases. So maybe those are contingencies. If we miss on defensive end, we're not going to take our 20th edge guy on our board in the second round. We'll just roll with what we have and try and make the team score all the points. So, so it's just one of the ways that I see that shaking out is if they miss, I think you're exactly right. I don't think they chase end anymore at that point, and they just line up and trot out the group that's already in the house.
Yeah, and I think that kind of actually leads me into my next question, which is about Malik McDowell. Because speaking of game theory and how this all came out, you know, the latest news out of the Stars that the Dallas, you know, brought in Malik McDowell for a visit, and clearly in my mind, what this is, and you tell me if you think this is different, but to me, this read like, okay, they did what they usually do, right? They set their 20 to 25 initial visits, guys that they knew they wanted to bring in, guys that they were targeting. Then they kept those some other visits at the end to basically just make sure that they had them for situations like this. And I guarantee you, I mean, I won't guarantee you, but in my mind, what I think happened is in the process of doing all these simulations and all these mock drafts and listening to all the people that they listen to and trying to get, you know, information about the other teams and who they're interested in, what they're doing, I think that – and I don't know whether it's at 28 or 60, but I think that – in the process of it, they kept on seeing Malik McDowell's name showing up in their range. And so they had to, like, you know, I think everyone's kind of like, oh, they're going to take Malik McDowell, or they like Malik McDowell. I think, if anything, this is them doing due diligence. Because the truth is, okay, bottom line, Malik McDowell on a talent level when he wants to play is a top 15 player. Like, I mean, that's without a doubt. When he's on, he's incredibly on. But I mean, obviously there's real concern about how often he's playing on and, you know, has a maturity issue, has, you know, the other side of what we call off field issues, which is really off field in the locker room issues, you know, and coaches calling a player, a 20-year-old kid, a cancer to the locker room is pretty strong language. So I guess, what is your take on the Cowboys' interest, and where would you feel comfy taking him?
Yeah, I saw that as a, you know, we know they keep things open for sort of wild cards. They did it with Gregory when they brought him in, you know, at the last second before the draft, and word sort of got out very, very late that that he had been in the building. And so with McDowell, I think you're exactly right. As they talk to more people, they kept saying, this guy's really going to slide, right? The scouts liked things on film. Do we need to take a look at him? And visits can confirm. And when you talk about that top 20, 25 visits that they set, they like them all. Well, we know they like them all, right? They've talked to him at the combine. They've been to their pro days by then. They like those guys. With these other ones, there's still some guys that they want to find out some things about. And I think that's how I took the McDowell one. What's he all about? He could be there. We know he's super talented when he wants to, right? The Indiana game, the Notre Dame game. He's unblockable. And then what did he do the rest of the time? Well, not a whole bunch.
Waited to get drafted, basically.
Yeah, right. And so when I see people say things like, well, he was just frustrated that the team was bad. Well, that's not really an option anymore when it's your occupation. Right. If I get frustrated because I had a long day at the office, quitting isn't really on the list of available choices to me, unless I don't want to work there anymore. So I get some real concern when that's how people are willing to explain it away. His production wasn't great, and people are happy to explain that away. He had a sack and a half for a guy that people talk about. Look how spectacularly he moves at 300 pounds. Okay, but if he doesn't get there, what does that do for me? He's incredibly disruptive in the run game. I think the year before he had somewhere around 15 tackles for loss. He's definitely going to ruin people's day in the run. But this team is locked in right now on adding a firecracker to their pass rush, not rolling aid into their defensive meeting room, which I think is what, at 20 years old, Malik McDowell is today. They've had players. Ryan Russell, they had a hard time getting him going, right? And so they got him going on the next bus. I have a hard time believing that they have love for Malik McDowell. I think if they did, he would have been in that first list. I think it was exploratory in nature, right? Just to find out. Well, because McDowell's also carrying around, we've heard people talking about him interviewing poorly.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, he interviewed at the podium poorly at the combine, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, yeah. So this is not a young man that's putting his best foot forward in the draft process. I didn't have at my fingertips, and I should have, but his combine results, but I don't believe that he fit even the Cowboys' love athletically, right, for what they like.
He certainly wasn't any more or any less explosive than he was any less explosive than David Irving. I mean, like,
no, I think he was significantly less so.
Yes, he was,
in fact, as far as testing.
Yeah.
And people are willing to explain that away. Well, he doesn't really care about testing.
What does this guy care about at this point?
What exactly is it in Malik McDowell's life that he cares about? What's the rabbit I can get him to chase and look more like a greyhound than he does sometimes? So
just to put it out there, he benched 23. He had a 1.69 10-yard split. He ran a 4.85, 28.5-inch vertical, which is just not good, really. I mean, he was at 295. He wasn't at like 300 pounds plus. He's still 6'6", 295. You know, that's still not great. But he did have an 11-foot broad jump. That's pretty good.
He cares
good.
About the broad jump. It's his favorite thing in the world. He's always loved it. He watches it every summer game.
That's the only thing he cares about. His broad jump is the only thing he cares about. He did a 7.69 three cone, so, you know, eh.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? And so, so for me, when you take – in the first round of a draft, ideally, I would like to see the intersection. And I was more of a trust the tape guy for many years, right? I'm watching him play football. He can play football. And then I came to understand, as I became more fascinated with the team building aspect of things in a hard salary cap sport, which makes football so unique to have such a big roster and that hard cap, I realized that I like thresholds and I like analytics as filters for film grades, right? So I understand that when you're making this kind of an investment with draft capital, that you're willing to miss on the one guy that doesn't fit into the size box for you in order to protect you from drafting the next 99 guys that are similarly sized that will fail, right? So, and I get it. Teams are, hey, if you draft that guy, and Carl Lawson, right? We've talked a lot about Carl Lawson and his T-Rex arms throughout this process, and I like Carl Lawson. I love how salty he is. I love his hand use. He did hit the speed metrics, not so much with the turn left right on the three cone, but Carl Lawson, he goes right in that linebacker bucket that I talked about for the Cowboys, and he's not here, right? He's not here as a visit. There's a reason he didn't meet the thresholds. If Carl Lawson goes out and has 10 sacks as a rookie somewhere, the Cowboys will say, well, oh well. We missed because there's like one other guy in the league with 31-inch arms that pass rushes like him. So, it's an acceptable It's just about what acceptable risk at that point and getting the right return on that investment.
I would rather miss four times than bust once. You know, that's the thing, is that because when missing, it's an all shucks. When you bust, you're on the hook for millions of dollars for a guy who can't play for you.
Well, and that's the exact right point, because if you miss on picking the guy, you still get a good player in his spot.
Yeah.
If you pick the wrong guy, then you're just toast, right?
So you lose the money, you lose the opportunity. Yeah, I mean, that's like it's a double whammy when you bust. You know, that's why, and maybe that's the missing part of the argument that we have just stumbled upon for. I've been trying to sell people on thresholds is because, yeah, exactly. It's not about finding the best athlete and thinking the best athlete is the guy you should draft. It's about finding the best football player who meets the minimum requirements athletically that are required to get into the NFL. And if you miss on the exception, again, it's the exception. It's very unlikely that you will miss on that. And when you do, it's an all shucks miss. It's not a, oh God, now I don't have a draft pick and I'm on the hook for a guy who can't play who I'm going to cut tomorrow.
And I'm going to have to pay him.
Yeah, right? And
it's a useful time to just quickly mention how I look at those athletic measurables. It's the size of the mountain between that player and true success in a league of freak athletes.
Yeah.
So if you have to climb Everest every day just getting out of bed to be able to compete in this league, that's a hard way to go through life, right? So I think that you'd rather take the guy that has no athletic impediments to his success. TJ Watt, there's not one athletic impediment to him being successful. Can you learn enough technique? Those are the kinds of things that'll keep him from it, but there's no athletic one.
Yeah.
Tyus Bowser, there's no athletic impediment
no problem
to
there.
Him being an elite rusher in the NFL. So when you get to McDowell, there are some athletic impediments. There are some attitude impediments. There are some questionable things on film where he can get his feet too close together and get washed down. He can stand up too high when he plays inside. When he plays outside, he can lack the speed to get home. So he's a little bit of a tweener. The Cowboys have gone Pokemon on that kind of guy and tried to catch them all in the past and filled up the D-line room with guys just like that. But but I do think that in the first round at that level, I would like to see tape supported by production and athletic measurables for a first round pick, even when I'm picking 28. I would like to see all three. It wouldn't be a bad thing if when I call the guys I know on his staff, I get some good references too. I'm not going to get any of those from McDowell. So for me, there's no chance. He's firmly in my please let someone else draft him bucket.
Please don't make me make that choice is what it is.
Exactly. Because talent-wise, when he wants to, you're almost compelled to take him as far as ceiling on a guy that you could get at 28. So I don't want them to be in that position because I don't want them to be compelled to take a guy they don't really have a day one job for and that has so many obstacles to real success. I don't know why for a young guy that has attitude issues already, why there would be any expectation that he suddenly gets switched on by reaching
the goal.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. His goal is to get to the NFL and get paid.
Yeah.
So once he's reached his goal, why is he now suddenly going to become all effort all the time? I don't think he will. Right. So for me, he's not there. He's not going to get to 60. I don't believe at 60, if they took him,
man, at 60,
you know, I'd probably feel very much like I did about the Gregory pick. Gregory was off my board, my personal board, right? Uh-huh. He was a box name. It's an automatic thing for me. If you fail at the combine, the drug test, you're a box name. Yeah, it's an easy rule for me. So Gregory was, but when they took Gregory at 60, I understood. They had to, right? They're compelled to by the grade their scouts gave the player, and they were willing to. We've seen this team consistently be willing to make that risk. So at 60, I would get it, but at 28, I don't think I could. So if he was staring them in the face at 28, I'd go right back to that list of really three guys, because Charles Harris doesn't carry that grade for me. I just worry a little bit that he does for the team. If anybody wonders why, it's because T.J. Watt might get a sack for me when a team tries to pass on first down. Charles Harris, I cannot put anywhere near the field if a run is a possibility. Charles Harris might as well be up in the box with Jerry on running downs because he'll be about as useful. And it's not just an athleticism problem, although that shows up too, his inability to change direction in the backfield and track down running backs. But he has a huge awareness issue where he gets upfield and he just doesn't know where the play is, and they run right past him. Underneath him, right? They'll let him run way upfield, and they'll run right back underneath him on counters and all that good stuff. So, but at any rate, so for me, Bowser, Watt, and McKinley, probably in the order of Watt, Bowser, McKinley. I do like Tack. I am intrigued by the fact that his feet carry him to plays he has no business making. It's weird. It's special. It's weird. But he also plays like no one told him he has 34-inch arms. Yeah. So I don't know why UCLA wouldn't have taught him any technique. So then my concern becomes, did you try and it didn't work? And why didn't it work? So I would have a lot of questions for their staff in terms of trying to figure out McKinley. Between that and the shoulder injury, which we hear is on track and he should be ready to play this season, but that puts McKinley at third for me, even though if the Cowboys drafted McKinley, I would still be happy that they found a right defensive end at least.
All right, so let's go ahead and just parlay this into the last question, because we've already kind of gone there. So go ahead and just give me your dream rounds 1-3, you know, reasonably realistic with no trades.
All right. And it's really the last two that you could flip-flop, but no matter what, it would be front-ended by a weak side defensive end. Been crying pretty steadily since DeMarcus Ware left, not because I thought that was the wrong decision at the time. I think we all thought with nagging injuries and those types of things that it was, and the money he commanded, that it was the right thing in terms of building the team. But their inability to find an adequate replacement despite many swings has been somewhat demoralizing. So it's going to be front end by a right defensive end, and because, again, I think that the weak side defensive ends that can improve this group are gone by 45. So I'm most intrigued by Watt. Several reasons. I think people talk about him not being explosive off the ball when Wisconsin plays a tackle read system where he's, you know, we talked about that transition from linebacker to defensive end. The core job one of linebacker is to make a decision instantly on forward or backward. You know, you take a first step forward, but you're really deciding whether I need to retreat at this point. That decision doesn't exist at defensive end. It's just go. It's just green light means go and get upfield. So
go.
Yeah. So, and I think we've seen when Watt had a blitz, when he had a go, plenty of athleticism there. You can pick the rushes out, not the linebacker play, but pick out the rushes and see that guy gets upfield, turns the corner, flattens to the quarterback. He shows different techniques, right? He does long arm, rip under. He's got a straight speed to power bull rush. That's pretty impressive. Iowa's left tackle can tell you that. So I think that Watt for me is the first one. I don't think he deserves a draft day bump for the name on the back of his jersey. But I think it does apply in terms of, is there a better pass rushing coach than the guy right down, you know, I-45 that you're going to train with all offseason?
I mean,
and who refuses to see you fail, right? So that part helps as far as teaching him about having a plan and having hand use and all that. Because TJ, for his freakish – I mean, JJ, excuse me, but for his freakishness athletically – he's a guy that also goes about it with a pass rushing approach, with a plan. And he's already talked to little brother about that. We've heard that in the interviews and those mm-hmm. types of things. And then also, this is a guy that when he talked to teams, he's already fueling his body like a professional, right? He's already eating on Big Brother's plan, right? He's already training on Big Brother. And when the Wisconsin staff talks about him, it's that this guy doesn't go out at night and party. He goes home and watches film. And so, I mean, we've made jokes about taking that to the extreme, about him, you know, intravenously taking unicorn protein and sitting in a hyperbaric chamber while he watches film. So,
I don't know if they test for it, but if they don't, I'm all for it. He should keep doing it. Intravenous unicorn blood all the way through the draft, I think.
Keep that out of the CBA for me. But so I feel good about Watt reaching his potential, whatever that is. So for me, enough about round one. I would take TJ Watt there at 28. The second guy, and this is where I say you could flip-flop, if it's going to be a safety in round two, just tell me which safeties are there. But if Utah's Marcus Williams is there, you could talk me into safety in that second spot. The Cowboys, I firmly believe, and it was reinforced by the visit list. It was further reinforced before that, when for whatever reason they did something they don't normally do, and openly at the combine they talked about one specific guy, which was Malik Hooker from Ohio State, who's the draft's preeminent center fielder with ball skills that touches footballs. And so so Marcus Williams is the very next single high safety after Malik Hooker, pure single high guy. The very next guy that covers from numbers to numbers and beyond. And so Marcus Williams very casually from the center of the field reaches sideline shots and then affects that pass. He has 10 interceptions over the last two seasons, even though he missed two games in 2016 with just an ankle, not a big deal. Passes defense, I think he had 8 this year, 9 the year before, so you combine those two. This is a guy that gets to the ball, a guy that reads quarterbacks, and gets there in time to affect the play at the catch point. So he can tackle. The reason he'll be more of a second-round guy, he's a bit of a drag-down tackler, but he wraps up. So he makes tackles. He's not an enforcer back there, but he does have good size, good length, and then his testing was fantastic, which the Cowboys are clearly influenced by. So Marcus Williams as the second guy. And then the third guy, when that brings you around to corners, I would probably take another long, fast, gets his hands on an absurd number of footballs, which for me would be someone like Akilah Witherspoon from Colorado. I know he's not a visitor, but they don't always bring in third rounders for visits. Usually it's mostly, and this year it looks like it was mostly first and seconds. But Witherspoon's an interesting guy in that he was 5'9 his senior year of high school, went to junior college, and now he's a whisker away from 6'3 after playing at Colorado. And
I love guys like that, man.
It's the Scottie Pippen effect, right?
Yeah,
the,
exactly.
Suddenly his athleticism grew with it. He didn't become this ungainly gargantuan person that can't move anymore. He just retained his 5'9 athleticism and suddenly has it in this giant package. So Witherspoon has some things, as you might expect, with a guy that has a third round grade. He's not the cleanest, smoothest. He's not Fabian Moreau in his transitions and his feet, but he had 22, I think, believe that's right, 22 or 23 passes defense last year at Colorado. So Colorado had an outstanding secondary in a pass-happy conference. But while teams maybe were avoiding some of his teammates like Awuzie, he was getting to footballs and making a lot of plays. So that would be one. If I flip-flop those, and I'll just give you one other combination, if Marcus Williams wasn't available as the safety, then I mentioned him already. I would love to see, even though he got hurt at his pro day, I worry a lot less about an upper body injury than I do about a lower body injury. And so if I could get Moreau at 60, I would probably make that pick. As smooth and fluid as that guy is and patient, while so many corners come out extremely grabby out of college and they grab everyone, and the NFL tends to bathe those guys in yellow flags when they get to the league to try and shock that out of them. Moreau doesn't. I've seen him frustrate receivers at the line with his press, where he's so patient in the press to let them commit and then jam them. And he doesn't grab because, as we saw, he has sub 4.4 speed. So he feels perfectly fine with letting you commit and then having the recovery speed to run under these guys. And you know, crossing routes, vertical, I mean, just a solid cover guy as far as man. And then if they do go to cover three or ask him to one of the coverages that I think is really interesting, and the Cowboys actually play a lot of combination coverages. We love to lump everything into it's man, it's zone, it's one, it's three, it's two. Truth is, the NFL is a lot more complex, and even a lot of college defenses, where you might be playing zone on one side and man on the other, zone on the back end and man underneath,
or patch or cover, like a what do you call it, match patterns and that sort of thing, like the Ripley's defenses, and where they do three if the receiver goes one way, and they do one if the receiver goes another way.
Exactly that. It's a lot more nuanced, and a lot of times it's all about making a sight reaction to the offense's alignment and pattern. Mm-hmm. You're exactly right. So and the Cowboys do all that. So a guy that's diverse, you see Moreau on tape when he gets to play zone at UCLA. He was in man mostly, but he'll play zone, and now all of a sudden, facing the football, he jumps balls, and here's a pick six. And so that's something that I want to see him trust it a little more, trust his eyes a little more, and be a little more aggressive on the ball in the air in man. But Moreau's a guy I really like. If he was at 60, I wouldn't take Sid Jones there with the Achilles, but I would be willing to take Moreau there. And then other guys in that area, you know, you hear about. If the Cowboys are valuing guys that touched a lot of footballs, you know, a guy like Rasul Douglas out of West Virginia, another long one, led the nation in interceptions last year. But I think that I could see someone like there. A bunch of these corners in the second round are bunched so tightly together that they could go anywhere from where the Cowboys are at in the late 20s to still being on the board at 60, just because of the glut of players. There are more corners with second round grades then will possibly be squeezed into the second round.
Yeah.
So if you talk about who's going to get 60, I could see Kadria Tankersley, easy for me to say, from Clemson. I could see him get to 60, and I could also see him go at 25. But you know, he's a press man. Put him on Beckham and let him beat the heck out of him. Put him on, you know, any of the other. We'll see the Eagles, and I was about to give a hypothetical of the Eagles drafting a receiver, but they certainly might, right? So let's say Philly ends up with Corey Davis. Let's say something horrible happens. But you know what I'm saying? There's a guy that you can press, but cover three plays like man as far as all the routes with vertical stems. So I think Tankersley would be a guy that's just fine. And I think teams will be – if a team doesn't play a ton of press man, they're probably not going to draft him. So – a guy that is a little more scheme specific is the kind of guy that slides down a little bit and could be there. So whether you flip flop, if Marcus Williams was there in the second round, I'd probably make safety the second pick. But if not, you're going to have your pick of four or five really good corners, I think, at that 60 spot. And I think that's what the Cowboys saw, just to sort of put a bow on it and bring it back to our initial point, that 10,000 foot view, that kind of depth in the secondary in this draft. And we didn't even get to guys like Xavier Woods, who they brought in for a visit, Tedrick Thompson from Colorado, later safeties. So yeah. if they take that corner at 60, there are safeties that are very good that that would come in here and start. And so I think they showed that they want to put a free safety body next to Byron so they can be interchangeable. They've talked about it forever and never had the personnel to do it. And Byron's not going to get away from his job of covering tight ends on every critical passing down. Not with the tight ends that are already in the division, in Ertz and Reed, who are very athletic. And then the Giants, tight end probably figures very high in their plans, whether it's in round one or two. And you have a bunch of spooky athletic tight ends in this class from, you know, I think O.J. Howard will be gone before he gets to the Giants. But guys
Njoku.
And the Giants have talked openly about the fact that a tight end that can run the seam is the missing piece of that offense. To make that offense go. And so someone like Njoku, someone, and they'll split them out too and let them play the way they did in college. Someone like Ingram from Ole Miss, who I don't love as a player, but if you want to just give him that role and stress a defense,
you can do that
all day with him. So I think that Byron's going to keep doing that job, and the piece they haven't had is a safety that can play single high behind him and get to footballs. And so the visit list, the fascination with Hooker, those things all said that the Cowboys want that, and they have the opportunity. There are a few of them that are running around in this class, and it's a rare thing too.
Yeah, right?
The Earl Thomases aren't everywhere.
No.
Well, they go very high, and Hooker will, but there are guys that have that kind of range, and several of them that have corner experience. So again, it lets you stay in base, and let's say a team, you know, motions someone to the slot, you can walk Byron down on him on one side, and on the other side you could walk Marcus Williams or Xavier Woods down and still stay, you know, feel good about staying in your base defense, not get run all over, and still be able to cover a slot guy, which is, you know, a huge luxury that the team could have. And that's the kind of luxury they had, you know, with a Darren Woodson. Way back when, of course, but Woodson would walk down and cover slot guys.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that these guys are Darren Woodsons, but from a coverage flexibility standpoint, they bring some of that to the table. So I think the class aligns with where they wanted to improve, and now football Christmas fast approaches.
Yes, it does. And as we start getting closer and closer, you guys make sure that you check out Keith on Twitter. He's at Keith Deuces. Make sure you're checking out FanRag Sports throughout the last week. They're going to have all kinds of articles from Cowboys related and otherwise. So make sure you're checking out FanRagSports.com. Make sure you follow me on Twitter as well, guys, at McCoolBTB. And thank you so much, Keith, for joining us. I had a great conversation. And as always, we get to talking about football, and the time just flies, man.
You can't keep me in a box.
No, I don't even hope to. I would never do that. I will never try to contain you. You're too beautiful. You must fly free, Keith, and to spread the good word, spread the good football word to all the people.
I'm a beautiful dove, and with that, I will fly away. But we will talk again. I think before the draft, there's a good chance.
I think there's a very good chance. Thank you guys, and have a wonderful evening, and till next time, happy trails.